we'd take a few moments to revisit a little-known episode in American sports history. When you hear stories of Japanese Americans during the 1930s and 40s, the focus is often on the internment of over 120,000 citizens and legal residents by the U.S. government during World War II, or the mostly Japanese American 442nd Infantry Regiment, which fought in Europe and was the most decorated unit of its size in U.S. military history. But during that time, there was also the unlikely athletic accomplishments of a group of Japanese Americans who lived and worked on a sugarcane plantation on the Hawaiian island of Maui. That's the story Julie Checkaway tells in The Three-Year Swim Club, the untold story of Maui's sugar ditch kids and their quest for Olympic glory. The book comes out in paperback next month. We spoke to Julie Checkaway about it last October. I'm wondering if we could just start, I mean, literally at the beginning of this story, because we're talking about children of workers on the Pu'unene sugar plantation. Now, even though they're living in Hawaii, they weren't necessarily near the water and didn't have that much exposure to that part of what living in Hawaii means.
That's exactly right. Pu'unene is in the heart of the valley, of the valley isle that Maui is, where there's probably less than about 16 inches of rain, if that, per year. And the only access they had to water to cool off in were the irrigation ditches that snaked down from the mountains and rainforests of Maui to irrigate the sugarcane.
Now, these were children of Japanese immigrants. How long had those families been there?
Their parents had come over, most of them, at around the turn of the 20th century. The children, for the most part, were born in the 20s, and they were, you know, the children of field laborers. Some of the parents were mill workers.
Well, let's talk for a moment about a person who's really at the heart of this story, and that is Soichi Sakamoto. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about him?
He's one of the most important figures in modern swimming history. His parents were very traditional Japanese, and he fell into a life of teaching in the elementary school at Pu'unene Elementary, and he was not an athlete, nor was he certain of his destiny. He had a sense of himself as someone who was meant to do something important in life, something of value, but he didn't discover it until fairly, you know, into his 30s, when he encountered the children, the same children he taught, swimming naked in the irrigation ditches. He saw them, and he saw the Luna, or the camp policeman, chasing the children out of the ditch. The ditches were forbidden because they were for irrigation. And when Soichi Sakamoto saw this, it touched some sense of justice in him. Mm-hmm. And he went to the plantation authorities, and he said, "Please let me oversee them in the ditch for 1 hour, you know, after school each day." And the kids who I interviewed, you know, now adults, said that in the beginning it was very free form. Coach Sakamoto, as they came to call him, would just stand upon the little walk bridge that went over the ditch and babysit them. Then one day, I've been able to pin it down to the fall of 1932, he looked at them and he said in an interview, he said he looked at the children and all of a sudden he didn't see them as labor camp kids. He saw them, he said, as bright gems bobbing in the sun. Hmm. And he brazenly called out, "How about I teach you something about swimming, eh?" And that's where it began.
Wow. And then when he goes on to form what he called the Three-Year Swim Club in 1937, that thing that he saw in those kids, he said, "Let's see how far we can take this." I mean, he said, "Work hard enough, and maybe you can get to the Olympic Games in 1940.
He didn't even say maybe, Magna. He said, "We are going to the Olympic Games."
And that was in just 3 years, right?
I mean, yes. Yep, exactly. And we're going to do it in 3 years. We're going to swim every day. And, you know, it's quite rigid. And he wanted them to have the chance to get off the island, a chance for a college education, and sport was not generally something that Japanese Americans used as a means to rise and have upward mobility in the U.S. at that time. But there were reasons why he saw in them an opportunity for them to swim their way against the current of their circumstance, literally and figuratively, to the middle class.
At what point in time do the currents of history, I mean, we're talking pre-World War II here, start intruding on this project?
Very early in the process. The aim was to go to the 1940 Tokyo Olympics.
Right.
And as many people know, as early as 1938, Japan pulled out of the Tokyo Olympics for many reasons. And then Helsinki became the site for the Olympics for a period of time until war broke out in Europe, too. Mm. So what loomed was this vacuum, was this hope inside that vacuum. Will we get a chance? Will we be still? Will the children, because they had become national champs within a year.
Right. So, I mean, that's actually something that that we should underscore here. They were successful. They were wildly successful. They went from being those kids in the irrigation ditch to some of them being national champions.
In 1938, some of the children traveled to Louisville, Kentucky, because they qualified for the men's national championships. And they performed remarkably, beating American champs, collegiate champs, kids from Yale. And so within 1 year, they were national champs. Within 2 years, they were beating all Olympic comers, and they became cause celebs. I mean, they were on the front page of every sports page in the United States and every major newspaper, including the New York Times, the Washington Post. These were big stories about these Hawaiian swimmers, as they came to be known, not
right.
Japanese American, because they became fashioned into Hawaiian swimmers.
Uh-huh. You know, we should note that some of the male members of the three-year swim club actually did serve in the United States military during World War II with the 442nd Infantry. So, I mean, they did their duty on the battlefield, even though they weren't allowed to swim on behalf of the United States, and you know, since the games had been canceled in 1940. But what happens later, though? Because the Olympics were held eventually, at least in 1948. Were some of Sakamoto's swimmers there?
By all standards, they were old men. Mm-hmm. When they began to swim, they were in their teens, and their early 20s were spent in Europe fighting the Axis powers. When they came back, they had one last opportunity to go to the very first Olympics that was held after the war. The group that was left, and there was a core group of about eight, they went to the men's nationals of 1948, and there they competed for a spot on the men's team. And I'm not sure if I'm supposed to give this away, you know, what happens. It's a story of tremendous triumph.
Julie, as we wrap up here, I mean, I want to return to something that you said near the beginning of our conversation, which is that Soichi Sakamoto is one of the most transformative figures in the history of American swimming. Mm-hmm. How would you describe how great his contribution was?
From a sports perspective, he invented active and passive resistance training. He invented stroke technique. There was no coach at that time who focused on stroke and individuation of technique for each swimmer. Outside of sport, he was a man who saw that the American dream was available to immigrants of all kinds. I would argue that that's an example for us today at a time when we're talking, so having such violent discussions about American immigration.
Mm-hmm. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you, Julie. Thank you so much.
Thank you.